I believe that it was Karl Barth, a 20th century theologian, a Swiss, who was once asked by someone, perhaps even a reporter, what he considered to be the most important doctrine in the Bible. And I'm sure that this person who was asking the question with as great a mind as Karl Barth has, was probably expecting perhaps a 15-minute dissertation on some aspect of God, His character, something that the Scriptures speak of as probably the greatest doctrine in the Bible. But Karl Barth's response was simply, "Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so." God's love. I'm sure that if we knew or understand better what God's love is all about, that we would probably complain less in our lives. But God's love is something that perhaps is a little bit misunderstood even these days. It's somewhat mysterious. And so what we'd like to do over the next 2 weeks, first myself and then Bill, will be to look at this concept of God's love, to discuss it, to learn about it, so that we can, perhaps as Karl Barth was able to say, or say with understanding and with real feeling, because he knew God and he had studied the Scriptures so well, that Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. And to truly be able to understand what that means and how that should affect our lives. We're going to skip verses 1 through 6 of chapter 4 of 1 John. John goes into a discussion about the Antichrist and false prophets again, basically, and I think Bill covered that well enough several weeks ago. So we're going to move on to verse 7. And I'd like to read this morning verses 7 through 12 of 1 John 4. "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is from God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. The one who does not love does not know God, for God is love. By this the love of God was manifested in us, that God has sent His only begotten Son into the world so that we might live through Him. In this is love, not that we loved God, but that He loved us, and sent His Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has beheld God at any time. If we love one another, God abides in us, and His love is perfected in us." Now, you probably recognize some familiar themes in these verses, themes that we've discussed already as we have gone through 1 John. In fact, John seems to repeat himself over and over again regarding these two themes. It almost seems, if you spend as much time as this on it, you begin to think that we really only have one thing to say from 1 John. But it's true that there basically is only, you might say, one or two things that stand out as what John is emphasizing through his entire letter. And those familiar themes have to do with the difference, morally speaking, not only inside but in terms of behavior too, the difference between Christians and non-Christians, that there really is a difference and also should be a difference. And then secondly, another familiar theme from 1 John is a demonstration of God's love. He speaks of God's love and the effect that that should have on us as Christians. So in verses 7 and 8, John mentions again this difference that should be there between Christians and non-Christians. He says the Christian loves, the non-Christian does not love. Why? Because John says the Christian has been born of God, first of all. That something has happened to a Christian that truly makes him different. Not just that he acts differently, but that he really is different. God has invaded the life of a Christian. And not just his life, but his very mind, his soul, his body. Every aspect of a Christian has been invaded by God somehow. And what John calls that is being born of God. So that now God has an influence over a person that was different before the person became a Christian. And so John says that a person loves, a Christian loves, because he truly is different because of what God has done. And that a Christian loves and a non-Christian does not love because a Christian knows God. But he says the one who does not love does not know God. Rather than taking a lot of time, just very briefly, the Old Testament word, know, as it's used by the Old Testament writers, was used not only as just simply people knowing God, but of also of sexual intimacy in the Old Testament. And the idea there truly is one of intimacy, of unity, of oneness. And so for a Christian to say that he knows God means that he is literally intimate with God. He is one with God. As God thinks, the Christian pursues thinking. As God would act, the Christian pursues acting. That if you see a Christian, you ought to see God. If you were to see God, you'd say, gee, I've seen that somewhere before. Ah, I know, my Christian friend. That's where I've seen that. That's where I've seen that love, that compassion. So this is another reason why a Christian loves and is different, because he knows God. And then thirdly, down in verse 12, the Christian loves because he has God abiding in him. And this speaks of God's commitment, his active faithfulness towards the Christian. Not just simply as we kind of talk about sometimes, God's living inside of me, or God is in me, he is abiding in me, but literally that God is actually too committed to me. The word goes beyond just simply where God is located, because where God is located, he is also committed. And that's what this word has to do with too. So that's why the Christian is different, and he acts differently, and he pursues different kinds of things in life, because he's been changed by God. God has invaded him. He knows God and is one with God, and also because God is committed to him. So there is a difference. Then in verses 9 through 11, John speaks of God's demonstration of his love, his active love. And how this demonstration of his love is the very basis for our behavior, our love for one another. He says that God's demonstration of his love is that he sent his Son, Jesus Christ, to be, number one, a propitiation. And back in chapter 2, we saw how this verse means that Jesus stemmed God's anger. He averted God's anger from us onto himself, so that we no longer incur the wrath of God, but instead the love of God. And he also sent his Son, John says here, so that we might have life, true life. Even if you have all the material wealth in the world, even if you have your health, even if you have your reputation, but you don't have God, you don't have Jesus Christ, you have nothing. And so a Christian has life. He's truly living, no matter what his circumstances are. And therefore, John goes on to say, on the basis of God's demonstration of his love towards us, we should love one another. So these two very familiar themes are right here in this paragraph, the difference between Christians and non-Christians and the demonstration of God's love. What I'd like to do this morning, since I went over that very quickly, is to speak of or to talk about this one phrase that John says here in describing God in verse 8, for God is love. And to explore that with you a little bit, to examine what that really means. And I'm going to warn you that I think I'm going to present perhaps some new thoughts to you this morning. And I'd like to suggest that if you don't quite understand what I'm saying, that you get the tape and you listen again, and I'll try to explain what I'm thinking as clearly and as succinctly as possible. But I want you to catch the drift of what it really means for God to be love, and to understand that. Because as I said, I think I'm going to present some new thoughts that if I taught this somewhere else, perhaps would get me a little bit in trouble, or a lot in trouble. So let's see what we want to say about the fact that God is love. Well, first of all, what is the typical view of God being love? When the average Christian on the street says God is love, what does he usually mean? Well, it seems to me that what is typically meant by God is love is kind of like a dollar waiting on a dime. That God has done all that he can do, and that he is in heaven waiting on us, hoping and praying that the sacrifice of his Son, Jesus Christ, won't go to waste. It seems that the typical view of God's being love is kind of this mamby-pamby, kind of ooey-gooey, emotional, you know, God is just dripping with this feeling and emotion and is just, you know, struggling and hoping and praying that people will trust him and trust in Jesus Christ, and that as soon as they do, then he can move in and work in their lives. But that if you really look at that picture of God carefully, it seems as though God is typified as a very weak person. That yes, he may have a lot of love and feeling, and I've even heard of preachers giving sermons where all they do is simply say, God is love, and they walk around and they hug people and to demonstrate how loving God is, and you just get this, all of a sudden everybody feels so good, and that's what love is all about, is just kind of hugging one another and feeling so good about each other. But I don't think that that's what the scriptures really mean by the fact that God is love. And I don't think that that's especially what John even means about God is love. And it's usually this verse, though, that gets used to describe, to bolster this kind of definition of God being love. Well, then, if that's not the correct view, what is the correct view? Well, let's ask a question. And the question is, if God is love, as John says here, then what is he not? Let's find out what he is not in order to understand who he really is, what he is. If God is love, then what is he not? Well, what usually comes to mind for us in our culture? If someone is not loving, they must be hating. Hate. If God is not love, excuse me, if God is love, then he must not be hate. That's the typical view, I think. That's what would normally come to our minds. To say, yes, that's what God is not. He is not hate. But why would we say that? Well, if you look at the word hate as it's used in the New Testament, it's probably because of the use of that word, what writers typically mean by the word hate. Because the word is usually used of an unbeliever in his relationship, his response to God, and also to other unbelievers. In verse 20, in fact, of chapter 4 here, if someone says, I love God and hates his brother, and their hate is put in juxtaposition with love, and hates his brother, he is a liar. But this word hate seems to have the idea behind it of extreme dislike. But if you examine really carefully how the New Testament writers use this word, it's not just dislike for no reason. It's really dislike for no moral reason. There's no moral basis for a man hating God. The only reason that he hates God is because God won't let him be what he wants to be, which is God himself. So the word hate has to do with its dislike, its aversion towards someone, but with no moral basis. Another example would be if I just simply say, I hate people with spiked purple hair. Or I get angry, perhaps, if a husband gets angry with his wife for the checkbook being out of balance by 50 cents at the end of the month. There's no moral basis for that anger. There would be no moral basis for my saying, I hate the person with spiked purple hair. But that's the way this word typically gets used. And that's the way I think that we tend to use the word. The way the New Testament uses the word is the way we tend to use the word too. to hate someone when it seems unfair, perhaps, for us to hate them, just for no reason at all, with no moral basis. But this is not the way I think that the Old Testament uses the word. In fact, look with me at Psalm 5, verses 4 through 7. Turn there. Psalm 5. Let's look at this and see what the psalmist says about God. Starting in verse 4, Psalm 5, he says, "For thou art not a God who takes pleasure in wickedness, no evil dwells with thee. The boastful shall not stand before thine eyes. Thou dost hate all who do iniquity. Thou dost destroy those who speak falsehood. The Lord abhors the man of bloodshed and deceit. But as for me, by thine abundant loving kindness, I will enter thy house. At thy holy temple, I will bow in reverence for thee." Notice what the psalmist says here, that God hates the man who does iniquity, the one involved in bloodshed, deceitfulness, basically in wickedness and in sin. The psalmist says that God does hate. But what kind of hate is this, though? I think we need to be careful in our in how we review this word here, as the psalmist speaks of it. What we need to do is we need to add the word righteous to it, that God hates righteously. And the righteous kind of hate that God has for the man who does wickedness is a hate that has a moral basis. It has a moral basis because those whom he hates desire to do evil, desire to be evil, desire to rebel against him, desire to claim to be God when God is God. And that is wrong. And so God righteously hates these people because they have rebelled against him. So we cannot say, therefore, that God is not hate. If we're going to try to find how you would fill in that blank, if God is not what? If God is love. Because according to the psalmist, God is both love and hate. Let me say that once again. God is love and God is hate. Now, please don't send this tape to Jimmy Swaggart, okay? I won't be alive next week if he hears that I've said this. But understand very carefully what I'm saying. God is love and God is righteous hate, both. Now, how can that be? That doesn't seem right to us, based upon especially how we use these words. So therefore, I think we need to correctly understand not only the word hate, but also the word love. Well, if you look in the New Testament, just as the New Testament uses the word hate the way we typically use it, it also uses the word love the way we typically do not use it. And that, I think, is where we really get into trouble when we're trying to understand the fact that God is love and God is hate. Because for us, love is, again, usually defined or usually denoted by feeling and romantic feeling and emotional feeling, this kind of hugging kind of feeling. It's something that is usually chemical that happens between two people. And also, if you really were to look at romantic feelings carefully, selfish. Because romantic feelings are usually there because of what someone does for me or does to me. That's why we talk about, boy, she really does something to me. Well, and that brings about this romantic feeling. That's the way we usually look at love. That's the way we usually define love. But that's not the way the New Testament defines love. When the New Testament in the Bible speaks of love, of the love of God, what the Bible is speaking of is mercy. God's being merciful, kind to those who do not deserve to have kindness shown to them. And another word that I want to throw in here is that it's God's choosing to be kind and love some while he chooses to righteously hate others who deserve it. So, on the basis of the fact that love, therefore, is mercy, is kindness, we cannot say then that God is not hate. He is righteous hate. But what we cannot say is God is not unmerciful. God is not callous. God is not hard-hearted. God is not compassionless. He is not unkind. He is definitely kind and compassionate. He is definitely merciful. So let me just go over these definitions once more very quickly with you then. Of love, the definition of love. We can see love as being romantic feelings. That's the way we usually use the word. But love, as the New Testament and the Bible uses it, is mercy. There's another aspect, though, that needs to be mentioned about love. Because the question comes up, can God really love and hate a person? Well, you notice that God, even though he hates the unbeliever, continues to allow the unbeliever to live. And there is a very definite sense of graciousness towards the unbeliever, even as the unbeliever continues to rebel against God. And so part of seeing love would be to see God's tolerating the unbeliever, giving him a temporal sort of mercy with temporal and partial benefits. So love can be, if we look at God, would be partially his tolerating the unbeliever for a while. Then hate, as I mentioned, the way we usually use the word hate is an immoral aversion and dislike. You'd be hating someone for no moral basis. But looking at God's hate, it's righteous anger based on another person's immorality. So can God both love and hate a person? It depends upon about whom we're speaking. We're speaking of the non-Christian. Psalm 5 says that God hates the non-Christian righteously. But he's also merciful towards them for a while. There's even a certain degree of joy and happiness in the unbeliever's life. And that is only on the basis of God's temporal mercy, because we all deserve hell. Towards the Christian, though, God never hates the Christian. He's always merciful. He's always loving. He's always kind because of Christ's propitiation. God got angry with Christ instead of getting angry with you and me as Christians. So what does this mean then? Let me just boil all this down in terms of God and for ourselves. What this means is, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so, that God has been incredibly merciful to me and you as a Christian. That God has chosen in and of himself to be merciful towards some, and he has chosen in and of himself to be justly angry towards others. Remember this when you're in adversity. Remember this when life is a struggle, when there's pain in your life. That God, if you are a Christian, God has chosen to be merciful towards you. He could have continued to choose to be angry with you. But he has chosen to be merciful towards you. because we all deserve to be in hell. So if God has chosen to be merciful towards some, that's mercy. Unbelievable. Because he could have simply chosen to be justly hating and angry with all of us. So that's, I think, what we need to recognize. That God is love. It's not a mamby-pamby kind of love. It's a choice that God has made to be merciful towards some. And because he has been merciful to some, because he has been merciful to us Christians, we are different. He has invaded our lives. He has changed us on the inside. He has gotten inside and monkeyed around with us as only our Creator can do, and changed us into people who will respond to him. And that's why he calls us to love one another. Because he has changed us into people who will love. And he's also called us even to love our enemies. Because he has been merciful to us. But let's ask the question, can we hate our enemies? God does. God hates the unbeliever if we define the enemy that way. Can we hate the unbeliever? Yes. Righteously. Righteously. But if I'm going to be angry at the unbeliever's rebellion against God and their evil and their immorality, I must make sure, though, that my mercy towards the unbeliever overwhelms my hate. And I think that that's what Ephesians 4 is getting at, verse 26. Be angry, yet do not sin. In other words, view immorality correctly. Be upset about it. Mourn over it. Be angry with a person who even continues to rebel against God. But Paul says, be angry, yet do not sin. Because our character is such that we would go on to, instead of being angry on a moral basis, it would turn to anger on an immoral basis. And we would be angry for selfish reasons. Our anger may look or may be righteous only for a moment, it seems. It goes on to be unrighteous anger very quickly. And that's why we need to make sure that our anger is tempered heavily by mercy. For two very specific reasons. Number one is, I lack God's omniscience. I don't know if that person with whom I'm angry righteously is going to become a Christian. They may. I don't know that. So I need to be merciful towards them in hopes, and that's what I need to pray for, that that person becomes a Christian. And the second reason is that my righteous hate should be heavily tempered by mercy is because I have been shown mercy. That's a major, huge difference between God and me. God has never been shown mercy. So his anger is always righteous anger towards those who rebel against him. But I have been shown mercy. So how can I continue to be angry with someone who has even hurt me and still say it's okay for God to not be angry with me? It doesn't make any sense. And so for those two reasons, make sure that you are merciful and loving towards your enemies, towards everyone, that your hate only is this much compared to your mercy, which must be this much. so love God's enemies, they may become Christians. Love Christians. They are God's friends. Choose to love, as John says here. But understand what God's love is really all about. It's not a weak, mamby-pamby kind of love. It is strong mercy towards some whom he has chosen to be merciful towards.